Good morning. The joint hearing of the House Tribal Affairs and House Community and Regional Affairs Committee will now come to order. The time is 8:03 a.m. Tuesday, February 3rd, 2026 in Capitol Room 106. Members present for the House Tribal Affairs are Representative Underwood, Representative Story, and myself, Chair Dibert, and Representative Carrick. Good morning. Co-Chair Himshue, will you please call the roll for House Community and Regional Affairs?
Happy to. We have Representative St. Clair, Representative G. Nelson, Representative Holland, Representative Hall, Co-Chair Mears, and myself, Co-Chair Himshue.
All right, wonderful. Thank you, Co-Chair Himshue. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. A quick reminder to please silence your phones. I would like to thank Sophia Tenney, the Community and Regional Affairs Secretary from Records, and Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. And let the record reflect that we have been joined by Representative Prox at 8:05. Good morning. I would also recognize in the audience, we have Representative Jimmy in the audience. Thank you for being here. We have one item on the agenda today. We will continue the presentation from last Thursday, January 29th, of the Alaska State Emergency Operations Center. Our presenter is Director Brian Fisher, again from the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, or DMVA. And he will be joining us virtually on Teams today. Brian Fisher, Director, Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Alaska Military and Veterans Affairs Department. Welcome. Good morning. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, ma'am, Kim.
Welcome back to the joint hearing. Please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation from last week.
Good morning, Chair Dibert. Co-chairs and members of the joint committees, for the record, Brian Fisher, the director of the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and I'm calling in today from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, where the State Emergency Operations Center is located. I appreciate the opportunity to call in virtually today. So at the end of the presentation last week, we left off just beginning to speak about Typhoon Halong. I'll just say, although many of us refer to this disaster on the West Coast in October 2025 as Typhoon Halong, it really was three separate storms that impacted the entirety of the West Coast, beginning with a storm that caused substantial flooding in the city of Kotzebue in the Northwest Arctic Borough. There was a storm immediately following that, and then the remnants of extra tropical cyclone, the remnant of Typhoon Halong, severely impacted the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and catastrophically impacted the southwest portion of the lower Kuskokwim Delta. So the photo that's up there is just representative of some of the most catastrophic damage that we saw. The two communities that received the most damage by far were Kipnuk and Quigilligach, although there are upwards more than 30 communities in the YK Delta that had varying degrees of impact from minor to moderate to severe. But Kip and Quig certainly very, very catastrophic. And I think I said this to the committees last week. This disaster, you know, I've been here doing this 31 years, and this by far is the most catastrophic that I've seen in my whole career here. I'll just note the picture on the right where you see some of the homes that are elevated on pilings there. With all of the damage and tragedy and trauma that has come from this disaster, while we move into the recovery phase, that's an important key to see those homes that have remained in place on pilings. That is a good news story, and I'll refer to that a little bit later in the presentation. If we could go to the next slide, please. I did mention this last week, and I think it's worth repeating that the rescue efforts that were made through the Alaska Department of Public Safety and the Alaska State Troopers, the United States Coast Guard, and the Alaska Army and Alaska Air National Guards, truly, truly heroic. There were 51 saves recorded as a result of rescues that happened immediately following the impacts of the Typhoon Remnant, primarily in Tiptuck and Quigilliguck. You can see the picture on the right, a helicopter with rescuemen on a hoist there. I said this last week, you know, I didn't think in my lifetime I would see a flooding disaster or a coastal storm disaster in Alaska that looked very similar to Hurricane Katrina, with the military and Coast Guard helicopters doing hoist rescues. What made this different than Katrina was some of those homes that you can see in the picture on the right, some of the homes that had survivors in them that required rescue had floated away from the community. I was in a meeting yesterday at the Alaska Forum with representatives from Tiptuck and Quigilliguck, and both reported some that homes were displaced from their foundations and washed away upwards of 10 or 12 miles away from the community. And some of those homes had residents in them that required rescue. So as always, our thanks to the brave men and women and soldiers and sailors and airmen of the Coast Guard and the Alaska Army Guard and Air Guard and our troopers for the heroic efforts that they provided in that rescue. I also want to say a special thank you to the search and rescue, the volunteer members of the communities that coordinated throughout the night when the storm waters came in to get good accountability for their community, to go rescue folks and transport them to the schools before the helicopters were able to get out there. Truly an incredible effort and a testimony to the resilience and the pre-planning and rescue work that volunteers in the communities do for their neighbors. Next slide, please. I think this is one of the most impactful images, the lasting images of the response to Typhoon Halong that we have all seen outside of the damage to the communities itself. When I saw this photo in near real time from one of our loadmasters that night bringing this flight of survivors into Anchorage, I immediately thought of the non-combatant evacuation operations that occurred in Afghanistan. Never in my life again would I have thought that we would have conducted the largest domestic air evacuation from rural Alaska into Anchorage. We're pretty sure in the state's entire history. We don't think there was anything greater, even in World War II, where folks were evacuated. I'll just say, this occurred for multiple reasons. In the communities themselves, as per usual, members all relocated, evacuated to their schools. The schools in these communities, like most of our communities, are built on pilings that were elevated and protected from the floodwaters. Local evacuations occurred throughout the night when the storm came in, and it was clear with the impacts to power, to drinking water, to the homes floating away, that folks were not going to be able to stay in those communities. So with the Alaska State Troopers and with the Association of Village Council Presidents and Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, the State Emergency Operations Center, conducted a very, very robust further evacuation, first out of the communities via helicopter. There was some concern initially for the integrity of the runways in the communities due to flood impacts. So we used our very large helicopters, our CH-47 Chinooks and our Black Hawk helicopters, to evacuate folks first from the communities into Bethel. And after a time, just because of the sheer number of folks we had to bring into Bethel, it was clear we were going to have to move them even further away from the region. And that's a picture here, one of the flights that we conducted on our C-17 aircraft, bringing folks into Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, and move further on from there to congregate shelters. And I want to thank the University of Alaska Anchorage for providing the Alaska Airlines Center for one of our initial congregate shelters, and the municipality of Anchorage for providing the Egan Convention Center for our second shelter. So more than 1,000 people were evacuated from the region, primarily into Anchorage. Some did remain in neighboring communities, and some remained in Bethel. But by far, one of the largest evacuations that the state has conducted in its entire history. Next slide, please. Following the evacuation, as we were taking care of folks in our congregate sheltering, there was, of course, a huge concern for pets and animals in the community. And I have nothing but praise for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, the Office of the State Vet, Bethel Friends of Pets, the ASPCA, the Municipality of Anchorage, the Matsu Borough. Kind of a second major effort was to evacuate pets from the destroyed or damaged communities, first again into Bethel, and then pretty robust reunification effort with all the partners that I had mentioned earlier to, you know, reunify pets with survivors that were displaced from the community. That happened for a very long time, and the effort was nothing short of miraculous, I would say. Next slide, please. Just some additional photos from the early response, our teams out there. You can see, and we typically see this in our flood disasters along our riverine communities and our coastal communities. One of the biggest impacts initially with floodwaters reaching up under homes is pretty severe damage to the board, that belly board that protects the homes, and insulation throughout homes. And I think I mentioned this previously, I'll just say it again, one of the exacerbating factors of this catastrophic disaster was we were really right on the cusp of winter. The response to Typhoon Murbach in 2022 happened in mid-September. This storm happened in mid-October, so we were that much closer to winter coming to the community, or to the entire region. So there was a very, very large effort on behalf of the communities to try to do emergency repairs to homes to get people back home before winter set in if we could. I want to thank the Department of Natural Resources, the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, the Alaska Army and Air National Guard, and the Alaska State Defense Force and Naval Militia, Team Rubicon, and the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities and their contractors, as well as the Association of Village Council Presidents, the AVCP Regional Housing Authority, all of those partners throughout the entire YK Delta region immediately following the storm, mobilized, divided the labor, if you will, and made attempts to repair homes, to get them put back on their foundations, to replace insulation as much as practical before winter, before hard winter really set in. The logistics effort was absolutely incredible. There's just a picture of one of our many warehouses we utilized with donations that came in from around the state. I will say that's always a complex issue for us, the well-intentioned donating and transporting materials. A lot of this went to Bethel, and Bethel was pretty full for a while with donated materials, even when we had many survivors that were in Anchorage and in need of that. So that logistical effort, very, very complicated to manage material donations following a disaster like this. So I want to thank everybody that was involved in that as well. Next slide, please. So I mentioned we opened up two congregate shelters in partnership with the university and municipality, and of course, the Red Cross of Alaska, the Salvation Army, all of our partners in the Alaska Volunteer Organizations Active in Disaster. But we knew early on that congregate shelter setting was not going to be appropriate for very long at all. So at the governor's direction, we moved into the next phase of this response, and that was to get folks out of the congregate shelter settings and into hotels, essentially, primarily in the Anchorage area, but also in Bethel and Fairbanks and some other places around the state. As we were doing that, it was very important to all of us and a priority of the governor's and mine to make sure that we were being respectful and treating our neighbors appropriately with a mind towards being culturally appropriate. So donations from communities across the state, coordinated through entities like the Alaska Native Heritage Center and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, were able to bring in hunted or subsisted food sources from around the state to make sure that folks that were staying in our shelters or staying in our hotels in Anchorage had opportunities to meet as community, to take part in potlatches and with traditional preparation of food and service of food to folks. We've done a number of community-wide events for that to continue to happen. I can't thank all of the communities in the state that donated and went and made extra hunts. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game authorized some additional hunts to collect subsistence foods to bring in to support the survivors as they were displaced from the community. I will say this, I mentioned this to the community of Kipnuk at a public meeting on Saturday and mentioned it yesterday. Just because of the sheer impact, particularly to those two communities, it's unlikely that every survivor that was impacted by this disaster and displaced from their home is going to be able to get back there this summer. I will talk about some statistics here in a little bit. But with that in mind, you know, there's roughly 200, a little more than 200 homes that we have categorized as destroyed just in those two communities. And then, as I said, there are varying degrees of damage and destruction to homes and infrastructure across the YK Delta. Because of the severity of the impacts to Kipnuk and Quigilligok, the tribal councils both passed resolutions requesting that survivors and residents not return home until we can get to this next summer and really restart and complete what will be a very significant cleanup mission, collecting home heating oil tanks, collecting contaminated soil from both petroleum products and household hazardous waste. The water systems in the communities were compromised, including with saltwater intrusion, which is going to take significant time to get a reverse osmosis water purification unit to scale out in the community to start reproducing safe drinking water. So there are a whole lot of things that need to happen that weren't able to get done before winter came and freeze up came in Southwest Alaska. Because of the scope of the sheer number of homes that have been destroyed and displaced and need to either be rebuilt or repaired, that is not an effort that's going to take a single summer construction season to occur. So we are moving very, very deliberately with housing partners in the region and throughout the state, with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to plan for that, the housing mission. We have made a number of requests to FEMA, including some authority that they have in the Stafford Act, which is the federal law that guides disaster assistance. A specific request we've made was for what's called permanent housing construction authority. That's been utilized in a couple of disasters in my career here. If approved, and it hasn't been approved yet by FEMA, but if approved, that will allow us to rebuild homes. That will allow us to provide labor and shipping support and material support, financial support to repair homes above what is the traditional maximum amount of financial assistance a homeowner can receive. I think I said this at the last hearing. This year, the maximum amount of financial assistance from FEMA that a survivor can get is $44,800 for the replacement of personal property, including subsistence gear. Homeowners are also eligible for up to another $44,800 for housing repair. And many of you and your constituents, your districts, you understand that $44,000 is not even a drop in the bucket for building materials, particularly when it comes to the cost of shipping and transportation of those materials out there. So this permanent housing construction authority, if approved, one of the biggest benefits, and we've seen this in previous disasters where I've used that authority, is that FEMA would help defray, offset, and cover the cost of shipping and transporting building materials into the community. That's really going to be a game changer if that is approved. We are working on the business case analysis of that with FEMA right now. I would say the good news is that there are many folks still at FEMA, both in their headquarters in D.C. and in the region, that understand the nature of Alaska. The acting administrator for FEMA, Karen Evans, was here immediately following the storm in October. She went to Kipnuk and Quinguilinguk with the governor. She saw the reality of the time, space, and distance, and geography, weather challenges that we have. So I feel like we have I'm optimistic that we're going to get that authority approved, but we're not waiting for that. So in the interim, we have been meeting, and I've asked FEMA to coordinate directly with AVCP Regional Housing Authority and Rural Cap and HUD and BIA up here, the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, to get that holistic understanding of what it takes to build a new home in Southwest Alaska, what the logistics look like with our maritime shipping and our barge schedules, things that can be done or would need to be done in the winter to prepare to rebuild a house or reset a house on a foundation come summertime. So all of that work is continuing. As we're having this hearing, I'll refer back to that picture of the homes that were on pilings to begin with. And I will say the homes that were elevated on piling foundations, you can see in the picture on the right there, they survived this flood largely intact. There was some flood damage, water damage to the lower portions of those homes and the insulation under the floors, but they stayed in place and they survived largely intact. In both of those communities and other communities that have boardwalks or board roads, those boardwalks that were secured with pilings drilled into the ground survived largely intact again. So I think that's a testament. We know how to engineer and design and build both infrastructure and homes in the area that are resilient to flooding disasters. And it has certainly been our commitment moving forward as infrastructure is repaired and the public infrastructure work will really happen in earnest starting this summer when the snow is gone. But when we rebuild and repair homes, we are looking at all of the options with the Housing Authority to make sure we can elevate homes above the new base flood elevation, if you will, the kind of the flood of record, and that they are secured with technology like pilings or helical piles. Or there's a brand name called Triadetic, which is a different type of steel foundation that can elevate and secure homes to make them more resilient for future disasters. There's been lots of talk about community relocation. The state disaster programs and FEMA's disaster programs do not relocate entire communities. That's not what they were designed for. They were designed to repair, rebuild, rehabilitate in place damaged infrastructure and homes from a disaster. So what I have communicated to the communities, all the households and the tribal councils, is that we will do everything we can to, as we're repairing and rebuilding, restoring infrastructure and homes in the communities, to elevate them, to put them on these pilings, to make sure they are more survivable for future storms, which we know will occur. And really that is in order to buy the community's time to have that longer discussion if they choose about whole community relocation. Like I said, our programs don't do that. We do the disaster, the immediate recovery programs, but we want to do everything we can to make sure the communities are safe moving forward as they have that much more complicated discussion about wholesale community relocation.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. I think this is a good time to pause. That was a lot of wonderful information as we understand this very complex event. And I would like to, we were able to reorganize up here at the dais, and I would like to invite Representative Jimmy up to the dais. So we'll take a brief at ease, and I think we have a couple of questions. I know I have a few questions on what you've presented thus far. So I'll take a brief at ease, and then we'll get back online, Mr. Fisher. Brief at ease. We're back on the record here in Tribal Affairs. discussing the Typhoon Halong impacts. And we are back with Mr. Fisher, who has done an amazing job with a lot of facts, a lot of just coordination across the state to deal with this catastrophe out in the West. I'd also like to recognize that we have Representative Jimmy here at the front of the dais. These are her communities, constituents. She's been to these places, and I just welcome her thoughts, and thank you for joining us, and anytime you'd like to add and take the mic, please do. I'd like to offer that to you. We have a couple of questions. I'll go ahead and begin with Representative Carrick has a question on what you've presented, Mr. Fisher.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. And through the chair, I know I was listening to you talk about FEMA, $44,800 that an individual can receive, plus another $44,800 for building materials, if it's applicable. So I wanted to confirm that that was the right information. And then I missed where you said what specific fund from FEMA that those come from. I just wanted to get clarification on that.
For the record, Brian Fisher, Director of the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, through the Chair, Representative Carrick. That is correct. The benefit under FEMA's individual assistance program, the maximum allowed by law and regulation is $44,800 for personal property and an additional $44,800 for housing assistance. Then that would be to repair or replace the structure of the home itself. That funding comes from the Federal Disaster Relief Fund, which the funds are appropriated into that particular fund by Congress. Similar in nature to the state's Disaster Relief Fund authorized in the Alaska Disaster Act. I will say the funding that comes for housing repair and replacement from FEMA, that $44,800, does not have a non-federal cost share to it, but the personal property one does. It's called ONA, Other Needs Assistance, $44,800. There is a 75-25%, 75% federal, 25% state cost share to that fund. So through the state DRF, we're going to be picking up the 25% of that, the non-federal share for the personal property funding that is being provided to our survivors.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Fisher, and through the chair, the individual assistance, and is that something that each individual in a family could potentially receive? So if you have, say, a family of five with three minors, could they potentially receive that amount or something up to it five times over, or is it just per adult individual or per family, or a little bit more about how that works?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, it's per household. So regardless of the size of the household, it's really one amount of funding per the entire household. So $44,800 per family, if you will, in both of those areas for property and for housing assistance.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. I'd like to go to Representative Holland.
Great, thank you. Through the chair to Director Fisher, I have two items I wanted to ask about right now. The first one relates to any insights you have to gaps in the funding and programs that we have or policies related to kind of the unique situation here. But to kind of get to that question, you know, I'm really interested in this notion of the flood of record that is helping us define some criteria for what I assume would be assessment and rebuilding. And I'm curious, you know, what we may be doing to not only use that to guide work within the current recovery communities, but also looking out and assessing other communities that might be exposed to the next storm and using that flood of record experience to help us anticipate where work needs to be done in the future, including the assessment of schools that are so essential for the community have a place to go, to have supplies, food, water, shelter, and whatnot. So Coming back then, what are you seeing in terms of gaps that may exist in funding programs and policies that would help us leverage what you've learned from Murbach and Halong and what we know about this flood of record notion and the exposure of other communities that perhaps may be facing this same type of threat in the years to come?
Thank you, Rep. Holland. Mr. Fisher.
Through the chair, Representative Holland. I appreciate those questions. So I would say one of the, prior to this storm, and this really impacts every community in Alaska, but probably more substantially to our communities in rural Alaska, is the fact that it's darn near impossible for either homeowners or municipalities or tribes to obtain and maintain insurance. Federal Emergency Management Agency assistance through the Individual Assistance Program, our state programs are not intended to be a replacement for insurance. So, we characterize that as, the disaster assistance that comes for individuals and families is not intended to make somebody whole. It's not a replacement for insurance. However, a huge gap that I've always seen in my career is that many communities don't have the ability, they don't have access to insurance. It's either unaffordable or it's unavailable in its entirety. Many of our communities don't have fire departments, so they can't get general, basic homeowner hazard insurance. There are some communities that do participate in FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program, but not all communities partake of that. And so I think a huge gap is insurance coverage. So when we come in following a declared disaster, the assistance we provide is really minimal, if you will. It's not intended to replace insurance. So there's a very large gap there. The programs that are in place, particularly the FEMA programs and the maximums and the Stafford Act, the federal law, because they're not intended to replace insurance, I would say they've never adequately kept up with the cost of inflation. So that's a minimal amount of funding. I think to rectify that, though, and a good thing from our perspective is the Stafford Act does anticipate and recognize some unusual and unique characteristics of states and territories that have large insular populations. So this Permanent Housing Construction Authority that can come to play if approved really takes into consideration the extraordinary costs for our supply chain, for shipping, for what it takes to repair and rebuild communities following a disaster in insular, remote, and rural America, if you will. So although there are gaps to the regular program that are out there because there are financial caps that are there, there are some programs that can come to bear. I think one of the other big gaps that I see, I've seen it in every disaster, is there are many, many, many federal agencies that all have a piece to play in this. Housing and Urban Development, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Small Business Administration. There's many, many entities that can provide varying amounts of assistance following a disaster. At this point, they all take individual connections and applications and all. It's very, very confusing for a survivor who is experiencing the worst incident in their life to navigate the federal bureaucracy, if you will, to take advantage of those, the myriad of programs that are out there and potentially available for this disaster and for others. I will say to your second question, there's been a tremendous amount of work conducted by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Geological Geophysical Surveys, the U.S. Geological Survey, on conducting modeling and mapping of our coastline to really have that understanding of what the maximum inland run-up of a potential sea storm would be, how high that storm surge could get based on the land, the data available via LIDAR and all of our mapping efforts on the coast, as well as utilizing what bathymetric data that we have, which is kind of the survey of the seafloor along the coast, to try to model and estimate how high, how big, how far inland a storm could potentially impact the community And that data is the most important data when we're talking about building schools, building new homes, building new infrastructure, to have that understanding that you spoke about on how high to build, how far inland would need to be built to make sure that the homes and infrastructure are survivable based on the best available data that we have and the modeling that's out there now.
Hello?
Follow-up, Rep. Holland.
Great. Thank you for that. The second part that I wanted to just touch on, and this I think relates to some of the funding streams you have available. To what degree do the funds that you have available, whether they're state or federal, specifically provide support for regional and local businesses to be supported, to be created, for job training to occur, so that to the degree that this is a multi-year recovery in these specific communities, but there will be other communities in the future, that local businesses and local employees are able to take advantage of the funding and the work that's to be done? You know, again, kind of the same question. What are the gaps and the policy issues that would allow us to ensure that more of this money that comes in for community recovery is going in to support and build up the local economy in the process?
Great question. Mr. Fisher?
Through the chair, Representative Holland. So just a couple of pieces there. First of all, the state and federal disaster assistance through my agency and through FEMA is not available to private for-profit businesses. There is disaster assistance available in the form of low-interest long-term loans by the U.S. Small Business Administration for those private for-profit businesses. However, we do provide assistance to certain nonprofit organizations in communities that provide essential government services. So if it's a nonprofit or a cooperative that runs a utility, say, they're eligible for repair and restoration funding through our infrastructure program. That said, we always look and work very hard with our state agencies and with FEMA and the U.S. Department of Labor, working with the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and working with our local contractor construction community to make sure we are making available, first of all, training, things like hazardous waste operator, HAZWOPER training. It could be flagger training for contractors that support the Department of Transportation. But try to get some of that training and certification in place, knowing there will be a need for that type of work in the community for the rebuilding effort. Just last week or 2 weeks ago, we had a pretty large meeting with FEMA and all the housing authority folks and people who build houses in Western Alaska to discuss just that. The communities have been very loud and clear. They want to be part of their own recovery, and a great way to do that and then to increase the funding coming in for the economy in a local community is to hire local or have our contractors that will be part of the rebuilding effort, hire local residents to do some of this work directly for them. So that's a cash infusion to the community. But in my mind, more importantly, it's to give the community members a place in the recovery. They're going to rebuild their community. And while they're doing that, they will be hired locally. FEMA does a pretty good job of looking at hiring locally themselves, whether it's in the communities impacted or in the region, as well as where their big office is and their temporary office here in Anchorage, have the ability to do some local hires directly for that. But our key is really relying on how homes are built, who builds them traditionally in the region, and making sure that we connect the communities, the tribal councils and the municipal governments, the residents with those entities to make sure they're available for hire to help facilitate and assist in the recovery and the rebuilding process.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Yeah, I'm just looking at these photographs, and it's overwhelming, like even where to begin. Do you begin with the boardwalks or the housing or the boardwalks to get to housing and the plots of land? And I'm sure that it's very, very overwhelming and just how to rebuild an entire community. So great question, Rep. Holland, as we possibly might prepare for another incident like this. Mr. Fisher, we have a question from Rep. Underwood.
Thank you, Chair Diver. Thank you, Mr. Fisher, for being here. And you may have covered this, so I'm sorry if I'm asking and you already addressed it. But I just saw yesterday a headline about the federal administration denying full disaster funding for Alaska, Western Alaska storms, and that Alaska had filed an appeal, and it just seemed like a big unknown. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with where we're at in the process, or you know the nuances as to why. Sometimes it's obviously not going to be in an article, but if you know any of those details, that would be great.
Through the chair, Representative Underwood, I appreciate that question. I'm from my perspective, that's actually, I'm not sure why it's in the headlines right now. That's kind of old news. But and I, from my perspective, it's been mischaracterized. We were not denied assistance. The state of Alaska, when the president declared a federal disaster for this, is providing us the same amount of assistance that they provide to every state when a disaster is declared. So the catastrophic floods in Texas and the hurricanes on the East Coast, we're getting the same amount of federal assistance that everybody across the nation gets when a federal disaster is declared. What the governor had requested in his initial request for assistance back in October was a deviation from that, was to ask for an increased federal cost share. I did mention the cost share we have for individuals. That is not waivable in the law. The president cannot waive that. But he can provide a waiver for a period of time for certain categories of assistance that is coming to the state. You know, the housing assistance that is authorized by the president's declaration is already, outside of the personal property, is 100% federal funding. There is no cost share there to the state at all. Most of the cost share is on our infrastructure side, whether it's repairing boardwalks and schools and power plants, as well as offsetting the cost of the emergency response actions that the communities and the regional entities and the state took. So the governor requested a waiver to that, an adjustment to that cost share. That resides solely with the president of the United States. That's not something that FEMA does. It's the president. He denied the initial request. We didn't hear that until December. I think it was December 19th, where we were officially notified of that request being denied. This disaster was declared a little unusually. I think most of you can recall there was a Truth Social post that said, we're here to help, $25 million. We don't know what that means. That's not the normal way that federal disasters are declared. It usually is listed in the Federal Register, and it describes the federal and non-federal share for the disaster. That just didn't happen this time, so there was some confusion up front. But what I can say is the governor has requested reconsideration of that, and has requested 90% federal funding, which would mean 10% state local funding for the first 90 days for all of the emergency actions that were taken, the rescue work, the evacuation and sheltering work, the emergency repairs that were completed prior to winter. So, and I can just say status of that is it's pending. That was submitted a couple of weeks ago now to the president, and we're just waiting to hear back from the president, from the administration on the governor's request.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Fisher, for breaking that down for us. Very helpful. We have a question from Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Fisher. So as often happens, I have some similar thoughts as Representative Holland. and am interested if you have anything off the top of your head about what is the scale difference between the flood levels here than have been before, or even more generally, how much are disasters escalating from where we were previously seeing natural disasters?
Through that chair, Co-Chair Mears, thanks for the question. So I would defer to folks in the region, but I can tell you I was on a panel yesterday with residents of Kipnuk and Quick-Gillingook, and both attested, and I think Representative Jimmy has heard this from everybody, this flood in particular was higher, went further inland than anybody can remember in the community. So I certainly would rely on the testimony of members of the community and elders to say that, you know, as far back as they can recall, this is higher and more extensive than they than they have ever seen. So I'm not a scientist, so I can't talk to the patterns, but, you know, Typhoon Merbok, there was some record flooding, if you will, in some of the communities on the West Coast and in Norton Sound. In this particular disaster, clearly there were new, what we call floods of record, the new high flood in Kipnuk and Quinquilinguk, maybe a couple of other communities. So I can't really speak to the trends. I just know that these coastal floods, as well as riverine floods, it just depends on how big the storm is, how much energy is in it, and the most significant factor as a layperson, not as a scientist in my mind, is the direction of the wind and how that wind carries all that energy into the communities. I think I said in the previous briefing, we were expecting initially for this storm to take, this typhoon remnant to take the same track as Merbok. So we thought it was going to go up and critically impact communities in Norton Sound, just like Merbok did. And then fairly unexpectedly, it kind of hooked right. It went pretty quickly to the east, which caused the devastating impacts in the extreme southwest portion of the Kuskokwim Delta. And so the amount of water that came inland and the height of that really had a lot to do with the wind associated with that entire storm and pushing it up into the Bering Sea and towards the Bering Strait. So don't have a great answer for that. I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. And I would just like to add on to that question. When I was going to AFN this fall, just about the same time that this was happening in Alaska, I was arrived into Anchorage and took a taxi to the AFN building. And the taxi driver happened to be from Kipnuk. And he was explaining to me kind of what was going on. I hadn't really heard because I was so busy with interior things. And he was mentioning that they're used to about four feet of water when on big storms, big storm fall events. And this, he said, was just incredible. They've never seen anything like that. And that was just from that quick taxi drive conversation. I didn't realize there were about 400 people living in Kipnuk, and I learned a lot just from that quick drive, and then I learned more at AFN, but if that helps. I have the next question from Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, Chair Dybert. Through the chair, these events, it's hard to get your arms around them, but is Department of Military and Veterans Affairs kind of the central planning agency for the state? You were doing a response, but are you doing planning as well?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, yes, we are. In our quote-unquote blue sky days, you know, we're always very busy responding and recovering from disasters, but the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management has an entire planning section that works, that's broken down into a couple of areas. They do mitigation planning to help communities identify hazards and threats and strategies to mitigate against those. We have an entire resiliency section, a rural resiliency section, that works directly with communities and regional entities to do things like building small community emergency response plans, to work on developing community emergency response teams, to look at, you know, planning for recovery if a disaster does happen. So we are one of the main disaster planning elements and preparedness elements in the state. We partner with agencies like the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, who does the community wildfire protection plans, to make sure that they're in line and they synchronize with our overall kind of all hazards, all natural disaster mitigation planning. And then we do a lot of the support for building community emergency response plans. So the schools and the clinics and the councils and municipalities are prepared to take care of their citizens in the initial hours and days following a disaster. So we do a lot of planning and preparedness work, sir.
Okay, thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
And do they, like this event in insurance jargon, would be classified as a 500-year event? And it's a little bit hard to say whether that event's going to happen tomorrow or 500 years from now. And therein the challenge lies, is how do we focus the funds and the effort spent on this in planning? Do you plan for 100-year events? Do you plan for 500-year events? Do we have folks that are thinking kind of on that scale, like a, well, an insurance company? They try to, if they're big enough, they think about 100, 500-year events. Smaller ones think about getting reinsurance and all that. Do we think, do we have folks that are thinking about it from that perspective?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, we do. The Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development within the Division of Community and Regional Affairs runs the state floodplain program. So they coordinate the National Flood Insurance Program and work directly with FEMA for the NFIP program, as well as a program called Risk Map, which does some of these study, these flood studies and elevation studies and 100, 500-year flood assessments, those types of things. For this particular disaster, FEMA and their technological assessment branch is working with the other federal and state agencies to look at this new, you know, how high the flood was from what they call mean high water. And using that specific information, I believe FEMA just published some recommendations in the Federal Register for this disaster on what that flood height from sea level, average sea level is in these communities to inform all of the work we do moving forward. FEMA has some very big programs that look at severe repetitive loss based on flooding disasters with the goal of making communities and homes more resilient so they don't have to come to the table for future flooding events. So a lot of that work is completed partially with my division, partially with Community and Regional Affairs, and then with our resource, our land agencies, resource agencies, and FEMA and the federal land agencies to do all of that research and assessment. We also work, you know, we work with the Division of Insurance and in the Department of Commerce as well. But DCRA is really the entity that does the flood mapping piece and the flood insurance coordination with FEMA.
Okay, thank you. Follow up?
Thank you. Quick follow up, so, Representative Prox.
I'm just trying to get rough orders of magnitude. I have you come up with, for instance, on this particular event, have you come up with a rough order of magnitude of what it's going to take to recover to some level of repair?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Prox. It's very, very early on in the disaster. I know we'll be working with your the finance committees of both bodies to talk about that. The governor has some proposals in his budget for state disaster relief fund funding. What I will say is it's one degree, it's too early to know. Like I said, the storm happened, the impacts occurred, we evacuated folks, and then winter came. So unfortunately, the kind of the nature of these fall disasters we have is it's going to take us largely through the summer of 2026 to get a full understanding of all of the impacts and costs that will be out there. As of this morning or as of yesterday morning, FEMA is estimating what they call the cost life of disaster cost to be $125 million. I would suspect, just based on my experience doing this for a long time, that dollar figure is going to go up. That estimate is based on what we know today, and there's a whole lot we don't know. We're going to have to get out there and see what the cleanup effort is going to take, what the what it's really going to cost to repair infrastructure and make it, you know, mitigate it, make it more resilient from future floods. So as of today, they're estimating $125 million through the life of this disaster, and our disasters stay open very long, and it's due to our construction seasons and all of that. I think that number will probably go up. we're somewhere around 170, I think, $170 million for Typhoon Merbok. This was similar but different to that disaster. So that's kind of the scope of what we're looking at there. And then as of today, in general, that $125 million is roughly, not everything, but roughly 75% of that will come from the federal government and 25% from us to support that rebuilding effort.
Thank you, Mr.
Sorry to hog it, but this related questions. If you
follow
have
up, a, Representative Prax.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. If do you have kind of a rough estimate of where we are as the state of Alaska in evaluating the risks and et cetera? Are we 75% towards the goal of figuring out what the actual risk is, or are we 10% towards that goal?
Mr. Fisher?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, when it comes to statewide risk, we have a very detailed state hazard mitigation plan, which, for the record, is available at ready.alaska.gov. That's my agency's website. And that statewide plan, which is updated at a minimum every 5 years, we update it annually and kind of re-look at all the science every 5 years, takes into account all the threats and hazards in the state. So it's storms, it's fires, it's man-made and technological disasters. So I think we understand the risks, but disasters do what they do, right? Like, yep. So this flood, there were some homes that were survived. In wildfires, you see evidence all the time of homes destroyed and next-door neighbors where the homes were untouched. So it's very, very difficult to really categorize to 100% certainty what the impacts of these hazards and threats may be. So we work with all of the agencies to try to characterize that as well as we can in our hazard mitigation plan. But there's just too much variability and uncertainty in disasters and weather and man-made events to accurately forecast that.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. And I'm really glad that you brought in the comparison with Merbok. I was thinking about that, just the difference, and I'm sure that you were there for Merbok as well with all of your experience and learned a lot. We have the next question from what's been presented from Rep. Himshoot.
Thank you, Chair Diver. Through the chair, Mr. Fisher, I have a couple of questions, so I might need a couple of follow-ups as we get going. I think I want to start with the question about the Truth Social post. I just want to confirm with you that the other channels that you mentioned have been followed as well. There was the post you mentioned, but the standard process has also been followed. I just want to make sure that what normally happens is happening, because you mentioned this sort of anomalous announcement, which was very welcome, but do we have the certainty that what usually happens is happening in terms of assistance from FEMA?
Mr. Fisher?
Through the chair, to co-chair Himshoot, thank you for that. The answer is yes. So there is a very rigid and formal process for states or tribes to request disaster assistance from the federal government. And in turn, the response, if you will, from the federal government on that. So all of that has taken place. We submitted what's called a request for federal assistance in accordance with both federal regulation and the Stafford Act. Initially, the response to that and the publish the announcements in the Federal Register, which can be seen on FEMA's website at FEMA.gov. The Alaska storms are one of those top disasters still listed on their website. So those things have happened. They have occurred. The formal communications, kind of the standard way, are in place now. We do have an additional request that the governor submitted to add additional areas of the state into the federal disaster. Federal law requires an assessment of damages to occur before the president can consider declaring a disaster for areas of the state. We got the initial disaster from them for the Northwest Arctic Borough and communities, all communities within the Lower Kuskokwim and Lower Yukon Regional Education Attendance Area. There are a few small communities within that area that are not part of those REAAs technically, so we've asked for those to be added on, as well as a few education attendance areas to the east of the main impact area that we have requested to be added on to the federal disaster. So we did that formally as well. We're waiting to hear back from that request as well. So I would say all of that is being done kind of the traditional way. It's just the initial announcement and the initial notification of a declared federal disaster did not include that cost share information that was usually there, and we didn't hear about that until December. But everything else is through the normal way that we do things in accordance with the federal regulations for federal disaster assistance.
Follow-up, Representative Himshu.
Thank you, Chair Dybert. Through the chair, my next questions have to do with the schools, and it's both the reactive. At one point in the immediate aftermath, I think the Kipnick School was supposed to run on multiple generators and had only one functioning generator. So I want to confirm that the incoming funding can both repair and upgrade the impacted schools, but also you've talked a lot about preparedness, so this might be a separate question. Going forward, we know we need to harden and prepare every school on the western coast of Alaska. How does that get done? Does that emergency preparedness fall to the local school district's budget, or are there funds that schools can use to make sure that all their generators are functional, that they're prepared for extreme storm conditions? So I think that was two questions.
Mr. Fisher?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Himshoot. So to your first question, yes, the repairs that we will make either for usage of the schools or actual flood damage to the schools, including their power systems and their water systems, that's all that falls within the declared disaster. So repairs and restoration of those services, cleanup of the schools, because not only were they utilized for shelter purposes until we evacuated the residents of the community, but have been used fairly extensively by our contractor folks that are out in the community doing some of the initial emergency repairs. So we'll be able to replenish and refurbish the portions of the school that we utilize for those purposes, as well as any actual damage. When it comes to longer term kind of capital support of our schools, that funding is usually in terms of what, as you characterized it, that's a cost to the school districts themselves. It comes through the funding that they receive through the Department of Education and Early Development. There are some programs that are out there and potentially available for this disaster from the U.S. Housing and Urban Development. They have a program called the Community Development Block Grant-Disaster Recovery. If that program is funded, there is additional funding available that could be used throughout the region to do some mitigation, some hardening, looking at backup power supplies and those kind of things. Those are all subject to congressional appropriations. So I hate to give the lawyer answer, but it does depend on what funding is made available in the out years here. The disaster recovery funding is targeted at the communities impacted. Some of that longer term gap analysis and needs assessment and recovery that could happen region wide, if you will, and sometimes statewide, will come in the out years, and there may or may not be funding available through the federal government to the school districts to look at some of those gaps that are out there before the next storms hit any communities.
Final follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Himshoot.
I should never say final, but I think it's my final. Thank you, Chair Dybert. Through the chair, Mr. Fisher, I'm also curious about environmental mitigation and cleanup. All of that insulation has to go somewhere. So what's happening, so to speak, on the back end? And my sincere hope is that no plane is coming out of these communities without carrying something out that needs to be removed. And this is an issue across the state with backhaul. But in this situation, the tremendous amount you know, I can imagine there's even contaminated soil. So I don't know how much you can speak to what needs to happen in terms of environmental cleanup, and is that supported through the FEMA funding or EPA, or is there some place we should be looking, and is that already underway?
Excellent.
Through the
question.
Chair.
Yep. Mr. Fisher.
Representative Himshute. The answer is yes, that is covered under the disaster itself. We rely on the folks at the Department of Environmental Conservation, the US EPA, and the Coast Guard in this case, to be our technical advisors and experts with their contractors on contaminants, contaminated soil, household hazardous waste, all the petroleum that may have been spilled from fuel tanks. The immediate planning that is occurring right now, and the DEC and the other agencies are preparing for this, is to remobilize their contractors to the communities once breakup comes, because we know a lot of the contaminants were just frozen in place when winter came. So there's a huge cleanup effort that's going to have to happen. We have had specific requests from the communities to make sure we are looking at all of their subsistence areas, and if necessary, based on, you know, rethawed contaminants, if you will, to get boom out in certain places to protect the subsistence areas to the extent we can. There was, I think I mentioned, lots of saltwater intrusion, so there's issues with drinking water and the drinking water sources as well. So in the immediate, we are planning to have our agencies and their contractors out there to continue that cleanup. On the same vein, we are communicating exactly what you said, probably not via aircraft, but we are working through FEMA with their logistical contractors to make sure if we're scheduling additional separate barges to come into the communities with rebuilding material, that they are planning to do backhaul. We understand very well that there is not capacity in our local landfills to take disaster debris and deal with that. We're looking at things like incinerators through some other federal agency programs that can burn some debris that is burnable, that won't contaminate the air. And then that whole concept of making sure the barges that drop off rebuilding materials be utilized to backhaul contaminated materials, household hazardous waste, all of the waste streams, if you will, to make sure that that's pulled out of the community, because we know that it can't stay in the landfill. They just don't have that capacity. So we are working on that planning right now.
If I could just comment.
And one final comment, Representative Himshute.
I know, final.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't say final. Comment, follow up on
Thank
that.
Thank you. I just am grateful for the recognition that when these people come home, it needs to be as much the home they left as possible. And so the recognition that it needs to be cleaned up and people need to live life the way that they've always lived life, I really appreciate your attention to that and the fact that getting anything out of a community is as hard as getting things into the community. So I think this speaks to your experience on the ground in Alaska for so many years that, and maybe this is just standard practice, but I know in my communities in rural Alaska, it is really hard to get things out of the community once they're there. So thank you for that reassurance that folks are going to come back and have as clean an environment to come home to as they left. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Himshute. I'm really glad that you brought up the schools. You know, through this typhoon, Alaskans learned just how important our schools are in our smaller communities, much more. Schools are much more than a place for youth to go in and learn. They're a community center and now an emergency center where people can go for safety. And that was very much brought to the light after this disaster. Mr. Fisher, we have a question from Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Dibert, and thank you, Mr. Fisher, for all your information and work. My question, and you might have a slide on this later, but as I'm sitting here and looking at all these infrastructure needs that are being met and the assessment and various things being carried out, I can't help but wonder about the things we can't see. Where in the disaster do we help with trauma supports from everyone who's been affected? Are there interventions, supports in place that do disasters recognize this need, and how is that accommodated?
Thank you. Through that chair, Representative Story, great question. I will say early on when we were evacuating folks from the communities, they were in congregate sheltering in both Bethel and then further on to the big shelters that we had opened in Anchorage that I referenced. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and local tribal health organizations and entities in the Anchorage area and in Bethel mobilized immediately. I mean, didn't even have to ask. They were just there immediately with mental health professionals of every sort to make sure that they were dealing with that, the immediate needs of our survivors that were displaced and evacuated, and the immediate trauma that was there. The governor did request two specific programs that are available under the disaster. Well, it's one program with kind of two time frames. It's called the Crisis Counseling Program. And the Crisis Counseling Program is a federal disaster program administered by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, SAMHSA. I apologize, I know they don't know the acronym for SAMHSA. But once approved, within that program, there are two sub-programs. One's called the Immediate Services Program for funding to come through that as a grant to the state of Alaska, which will end up with the Division of Behavioral Health. To pass through grant funding to our regular regional and local mental health service providers to hire additional staff to continue to make sure that that support is available. So the immediate services is a shorter time frame, and then in that crisis counseling program, there's a regular services program that will provide additional funding from U.S. Health and Human Services through us and the Department of Health, Division of Behavioral Health, out to our mental health providers across the state to continue to add, increase additional capacity to provide that additional mental health support that will be needed for folks that have experienced this horrible trauma.
Follow-up, Rep. Story?
Yes, thank you for that. I'm glad to hear about that. My other thought has to do with going back to our schools. And do you know if there is any, through the Department of Education, any recognition that that is a hub for where children return to, and do they get extra counselors, supports in their school communities?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Story, yes, that will be coordinated directly with the schools and the school districts themselves and our mental health care providers with all the entities, both regionally and statewide, is to make sure that type of support would be available to children when schools are back up and running and kids are back in learning in their communities, in their schools.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. We have another question from Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Fisher, I want to express my deep gratitude and appreciation for all of the work that you and members of your team and all others who were involved in the disaster response, for your work and your dedication to our state and to our Alaskans, especially our friends and neighbors in Southwest Alaska. I've had some exposure to emergency operations centers through a couple of past career opportunities that I've had, and I know the stress, and I'm familiar with the stress and the pressure that is involved with that kind of a response. I also consider myself a lifelong learner when it comes to ways in which we can always improve, and I'm curious, because this disaster was of such an order of magnitude that we have not seen in this state, is there anything that you wish that you had done differently, or is there anything that you think we can improve upon for the next time that this happens? Because it seems as though we're all recognizing that this will happen again. Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Hall. Mr. Fisher?
Through the chair, Representative Hall. First, let me say thank you. I appreciate that. I may have been here a long time. I'm only the agency head. But my 64 positions, roughly 55 employees right now, are really, they are the greatest Alaskans that there can be. They are dedicated to taking care of their friends and neighbors, and they all work very, very hard day in, day out, many times 7 days a week, to make sure we're supporting our communities and our residents that are impacted by these things. So I definitely appreciate that. Thank you. I think probably one of the greatest positive things that had occurred prior to the disaster was the development in our division of this Rural Resiliency Unit. We conduct a series of events called Rural Resiliency Workshops. And prior to Halong and the other couple of storms that impacted the West Coast, we had been doing a great partnership with the Association of Village Council Presidents to bring in community leaders from all of the tribes in the AVCP region into Bethel for an intensive week-long workshop to talk about all of this pre-planning, about how you write a local emergency plan, how you coordinate with your schools, the things that you need to look at when a disaster strikes in the first 24 to 72 to 96 hours, the process of requesting assistance, all of those kind of preparedness activities. We were, because the AVCP region is so large, we had broken up the region into three subregions, if you will, to do these workshops. We bring in all partners from the Coast Guard and from Division of Forestry and Fire Protection and DEC and all sorts of agencies, the Alaska State Troopers, to come in and provide that training ahead of storms. And we accomplished two of those subregions in the last 2 years. The third workshop was going to be scheduled this month at AVCP's request. We have delayed that because of the disaster. So I would say, I think what we've learned is that workshop and that partnership with regional entities, bringing in our local communities to build that capacity and understanding of emergency operation centers and disaster response and recovery. We need to do more of that. I think that's my biggest lesson. It's a huge success. We were able to communicate with officials from communities in the entire YK Delta region. And they understand the language we speak when it comes to emergencies and disaster response. Now, that wasn't always the case. They know how to communicate their needs clearly and concisely to us so we can target that response effort and the recovery effort. And I feel like more of that needs to happen. And it's really a statewide an issue. You know, I have a couple of individuals in that section that work this program, and the need is statewide for all of our capacity and capability building, if you will, with our local units of government, whether they be tribal or municipal. And I really think that it was proven a success in how we were able to respond to this event. And in other regions of the state, we've done this since about 2015. And I just think we need to continue doing more and more of that to build that capacity for all of the new leaders that we see in all of our communities. Probably number one.
Follow-up, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given what you know at this point, Director Fisher, are there any barriers to you being able to accomplish what you just shared?
Through the chair, Representative Hall, no specific barriers. We have that entity in place. We continue to get greater and greater cooperation and work with our regional entities, many of them, the tribal nonprofits or the tribal health nonprofits that support us with that. We continue to just grow the program and kind of multiply its effect using village public safety officers through the various entities that are out there. Our partners at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium are a huge part of that. So I don't think there are any barriers. It's just time. There are many communities in the state. We can't go to every community every single year. That's just impractical. But I think we're in a good position to continue that preparedness work moving forward.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fisher, for that explanation. And I just think about what you mentioned on Thursday of bringing out elders on flights during the when an emergency is about to happen, and watching the going out on the flight and watching the water, and then the elders are able to go back to the community and speak in their native language, what's coming. And just more programs like that. That was a great story and effort out there. And that one that we could use statewide when these disasters are about to happen. We have a couple more questions. I'm in the queue. I'd like to go to the subsistence that where there was the slide that had the, it looked like maybe a moose hide or caribou hide. Yeah, that one. Can you tell us more about, you know, this photo of getting subsistence food to the folks who came into Anchorage, I'm assuming, or what organizations did you work with to make sure that people got, you know, food that would nurture them? Thank you so much.
Yeah, to the chair, I believe this picture was seal. And as I had mentioned, the Department of Fish and Game had authorized some extended time periods for a collection of subsistence products to be brought in to where our survivors were displaced. So I think this was some residents of the communities in Anchorage preparing seal for one of our community meetings that was occurring. Really a huge, huge partner. You might not think this, but the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage really stepped up to the plate and worked with folks from AVCP and from Chilista Corporation and others to support this effort to make sure that where possible, culturally appropriate food was available. Every public meeting and event that we had a number of survivor workshops and all, public meetings. The folks that set up the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund with the Alaska Community Foundation, it was really kind of an all hands on deck, working with folks, the dietitians from the Alaska Native Medical Center at ANTHC, making sure that we were providing where we could that appropriate food sources for these big public venues that we're having. The Native Heritage Center expanded some and worked with other partners to build some pretty good refrigerated or freezer capacity to continue to collect donations, either from new hunts or from available subsistence products to get them shipped into Anchorage and have those stored and available to either be prepared or be delivered to survivors in either their hotels. And now our big effort is moving folks to apartments. So that effort is continuing to go on. I will just say above that, we understand when these floods happen and there's a loss of power in communities that many residents lose all of their subsistence material, right? That it spoils because there's no power. It's a huge challenge. So Commissioner Vincent Lang and those folks supporting additional collection of subsistence materials, whether it's eggs or berries or fish or walrus or seal, whatever it is, that will be available for folks when they get back into their homes. We cannot, the state disaster programs and FEMA's programs can't replace the material itself, but we have worked with FEMA and convinced them, this is unique to Alaska, where they do provide out of their benefit, their financial benefit to homeowners, funding to replace, essentially money to replace the loss of subsistence food. It was originally authorized at $1,000 per household. I requested them to up that to at least $2,000. Mm. There is a cap there. It's all within that $44,800. But that is a unique consideration and approval we got from FEMA that recognizes the criticality of subsistence food for our communities when they're impacted by disasters such as this. So that financial assistance is there as well. It obviously doesn't replace everything that was lost, but it's assistance that residents of this country and other states don't get. So I'm glad that that's out there and that FEMA supports that for us, recognizes that need.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Fisher, for describing how that all went down. And I remember in the interior, if we got a second moose, we were able to donate it to the survivors of this. And I know, like, there's nothing more healing after any kind of traumatic experience that there's nothing better than a hot bowl of moose soup. So I know how important that is after something like this for those folks. We have Representative Carrick with a question.
Thank you, Director Fisher. Just wanted to say again, reiterate what everybody has said, which is just our deepest gratitude to you and to the team that works behind you that we're not hearing from today, but certainly have so much appreciation for. I wanted to kind of follow up on Representative Hall's question because I think that was a really good line of inquiry. And I just want to, I know there's probably many, many things we could do both short-term and long-term related to Halong recovery and to disaster preparedness in general. But I wanted to ask you a twofold question. In your mind, what is maybe one important way the legislature can help in the short term related to Halong recovery? And secondly, what is one long-term thing the legislature should be doing to support disaster preparedness for any disaster that might take place in Alaska? In other words, what do you need right now? What do you most need right now from the legislature? Mr. Fisher?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, thank you for that. I think in the short term, my ask would be to support the governor's proposed budget for the disaster relief fund. That is the mechanism that gets this assistance to repair and rebuild to this community. Those funding requests are usually all-encompassing of kind of all the open disasters that we've had. We've had a couple of other state-declared disasters since this storm. There was a windstorm in the Mattsu Valley and a utility failure in the Posquiac that we're continuing to work on. So in the immediate, the support that we've always received from the legislature on that state disaster funding side is incredibly important. I know you all know this because of the lack of robust revenue and tax bases in our local communities. It really, and us being such a young state and an infrastructure poor state, that funding from the legislature on the kind of on the state level is critical to the survivability and the ability to recover for our rural communities that don't necessarily have that robust revenue base there. So that is probably the number one thing in the short term is that funding there. I will just say, as of today, FEMA has already approved $37 million for the state for Halong. The majority of that, roughly $33 million, directly to homeowners, directly to households and individuals. That is an unbelievable amount of funding. That's primarily, like I said, on the individual and family side. There will be a huge amount of funding as we start looking at the rebuilding projects of infrastructure and what that cost is going to be. And there is a cost share to the state associated with that. So that support is going to be critical to affect this recovery. I think as a legislature, whether it's policy or anything else, that just the acknowledgement that disasters are going to continue to occur, whether they're weather-induced, whether they're technological or man-made. You know, we certainly do have, you know, nation-state threats that this state is dealing with as well. So the support of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and I'll call them the traditional response agencies, the Department of Natural Resources, Environmental Conservation, Department of Public Safety, the Corrections, the Department of Education for our schools, that kind of holistic support to improve the health of a community really lends to the term resilience, right? The ability for a community to bounce back quicker following one of these catastrophic events. It's really a whole of community issue. So it kind of affects all of the agencies of the state and our federal partners that live and work up here to keep that continuing. Our agency is, you know, unfortunately well practiced in the response and recovery piece. We do and will always continue to focus on the preparedness piece to build that resilience in our communities. And I think the reality of the federal situation with the administration and with Congress is that they are looking to states to take more of the burden directly. So I would say we don't know what that will look like. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is still under an executive order looking at what FEMA and what federal disaster assistance and emergency management should look like in the future. There is potential that the buck is going to be passed on to state and local and tribal governments more than it has been traditionally. So I think the legislature needs to be prepared to consider the fact that we may have to deal with more of these disasters on our own. And that's going to be a tough reality for all states and all localities across the country. But that's kind of the chatter that we're hearing coming out of the Beltway. So as we move forward and identify real changes to federal emergency management support, we're gonna need the legislature's support to adjust to whatever that new reality is going to look like. It's all uncertain as today, but it certainly seems like the conversation is going to more responsibility shifted to us. Just, I know that's a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Follow up, Representative Carrick.
Just a thank you to Director Fisher. I know we've all said it today, but and thank you also to the agencies that provided support during Halong and for any of our other disasters. I hope that in our transportation committee we can cover specifically how DOT assisted. I know that the schools are instrumental, and as Representative Himshute mentioned in the last hearing, teachers are sometimes the last to leave the community because they're providing a lot of support for the community. So, you know, thank you for recognizing those other agencies that helped, and thank you again.
Thank you, Rep. Carrick. And I'm just going to do a time check. Before that, I would like to, for the record, recognize Representative Ruffridge joined us at 9:26. Good morning. And doing a time check, we have about 20 minutes left. We have a couple of questions from representatives, and at closer to in a few minutes, I would like to give the floor to Representative Jimmy for comments and final questions. So let's go ahead and go to Representative Holland.
Thank you, and through the chair, back to Director Fisher. One of the things that I thought was really startling, if not valuable in terms of community learning in this Halong event, was how that event came to Anchorage and South Central. This wasn't something that happened somewhere out in far away Alaska. The transportation of people, the congregate housing, the effort through the Anchorage School District to place students really brought this disaster, I think, in a new way to more people in Alaska and to South Central to realize that this actually impacts all of us in a new way. And as a result, it raises a question about what is happening in terms of the planning and the capacity to deal with the cross-jurisdictional or cross-geographic impact of these disasters, where we now maybe need to be more prepared for support from either regional hubs or even in the case of this situation where Anchorage now became a place to support people impacted by a disaster. And do we have the planning to work across those kind of jurisdictions for Anchorage to be ready for a storm in Western Alaska? I think that's a new paradigm of planning and capacity building. And as a follow-up to that, do we have the funding to help Anchorage cover some of the costs that they may have borne in responding and supporting families? And do we have the funding that will help the families that have been in Anchorage all winter, and I think also the Matsu Valley, to help them get back to their communities? I think this is a different paradigm that we're in, and I'm wondering what your view of that is and how that changes some of our planning capacity and the programs that will support making everyone whole given this new way this disaster impacted Alaska and different jurisdictions.
Mr. Fisher.
Through the chair, Representative Holland, again, really great questions. I appreciate that. This is a relatively new paradigm for long-term housing of displaced survivors in Anchorage, if you will. But we have a pretty substantial amount of history and experience doing this in Fairbanks, in the Fairbanks North Star Borough. There have been, I remember when I first started here, there was a catastrophic event on the Koyukuk River that impacted Hughes, Alotna, and Allakaket, and we had to relocate, displace folks from those communities into Fairbanks. We utilized the Carlson Center up there back in 94, 95 to house folks for the long term out of their communities in the interior until we could get those particular communities that were impacted by a river flood back up and running and get people home. So we have done that in the past. We definitely rely and work with our regional and statewide tribal organizations to support these efforts. I definitely think it's critical to recognize the support that the Association of Village Council Presidents and Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation has provided for this disaster, as well as what we refer to as host communities. So Anchorage has not seen anything to this level in a very long time. However, they immediately stepped up to the plate, and all the things you mentioned, to provide local transportation service, to coordinate with the social services agencies of the municipality in the area, provide recreation opportunities, the Anchorage School District above and beyond, incorporating students from the displaced communities into classrooms in Anchorage and bringing their teachers in to help maintain that continuity for learning. All of that incredibly important. All of those costs that were incurred for opening up the Egan Center and the Airline Center and providing people mover passes in Anchorage or transportation passes in Fairbanks or other areas, and you're right, it does include the Matanuskas who sit in a borough, all of those are eligible emergency costs to be reimbursed to those communities for their service, for their support of taking care of displaced survivors. So we have processes in place. You know, on the FEMA side, they call it host state policies because they're used to evacuating the coastal states inland in southeast for hurricanes. We do the same thing with FEMA on the kind of city, you know, community to the community side in Alaska. So those costs incurred to take care of these the new residents, their neighbors that are now here for the long term are all eligible costs that we'll be able to reimburse through the FEMA disaster programs that are there.
Thank you so much, Mr. Fisher. And as a resident of Fairbanks, I do remember that crisis in Fairbanks where everyone was staying at the Carlson Center. It opened up in the beds and just, you know, it takes everyone to come together to help communities. Thank you for that question. And Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Dibert. Through the chair, a couple of things, and you said it in the last hearing too. You said I have 66 positions and 55 people, and I'm wondering why the vacancies. I'm wondering if the hiring freeze is affecting your department. And then another question, I'll just ask it right away. You had made a comment that right now you're still moving folks to apartments. Are they still in congregate living? I mean, that's a long time. Anyway, so those two questions, please.
Through the chair, but to the last question, we shut down the congregate sheltering within 2 weeks of getting folks into Anchorage and moved folks into hotels. So we still, at its peak, we had 178 households, 682 individuals in hotels, in six hotels in Anchorage. And we are working now to move folks out of the hotel living into apartments. So another huge shout out to CEO Butcher, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation worked with the market, that the apartment market, if you will, to identify apartments that were available to get folks transitioned into. We are down to below 90 households. We're at 82 households and 400 individuals that still need to move out of the hotels into apartments. It's a long, intensive process to get folks their deposits and get background checks for the landlords and furnish those apartments so they have utensils and furniture and all. So we're continuing to do that. And we expect folks to stay in those apartments until we can clean up the communities and rebuild their homes and get them back home. The rental assistance for those apartments, if you will, is coming directly from FEMA. So that is not a cost to the state. That's federal funding that is providing that rental assistance. So that is continuing. We're trying to move folks there. I have 64 full-time positions authorized, and I think we're somewhere around 55 or 56 that are filled. Due to a myriad of reasons, just people retiring, moving to other jobs. Unfortunately, we had in the middle of this disaster a couple of deaths of staff members, which was pretty challenging to deal with. So the hiring waiver process is not affecting us at all. We're the administration recognizes the criticality of our position, so that has not been an issue at all. The time for my staff to get the recruitments out and conduct interviews and do the hiring and all was a little bit delayed because we were 100% focused on survivors from this disaster for the first couple of months. We're moving through the various processes of recruitment and hiring now, and I don't really see an issue with that. I would say kind of we see typical turnover that state agencies have. We did have a delay in trying to fill some of those vacancies just because we were focused on the response to this disaster, but we're moving forward now just fine, I think.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Rep. Story, and thank you, Mr. Fisher, for those words. It's such a large undertaking that you're still working to keep people safe and, you know, taking care of them, even though it's February. So thank you for that question, Representative Story. So time check, we have about 13 or so minutes. If you have further questions, follow-up questions can go to my office at rep.maxine.diber@akledge.gov or to my staff, Almaria. I know we won't be able to get to all questions or comments, but I would like now to give the floor to Representative Jimmy, who was there on the ground. These are her communities. I'm sure very involved and still involved, I'm sure, with this Typhoon Halong. So, Representative Jimmy, if you'd like to say a few words and any comments for...
Guyana, Madam Chair, and it's good to see you again, Director Fisher. I hope all is well with you, and thank you for all your work in helping District 38 and also other rural communities that have been impacted. There's too many village communities named to name, but I'd like to share about being out in the storm. So I was supposed to fly in for the early into Anchorage, and I didn't know about the storm. I wasn't tracking it until my daughter said, you know, they're declaring this a really bad storm. And I was like, well, I'll just stay. And my daughter kept egging me on to leave Tuksuk, and I, you know, she wouldn't stop, and planes were flying even as the winds were picking up, and I just kept saying no. Not long after the evening came, so it was my daughter, my niece up there at my place, and not long after, the wind started picking up, and all you could do was just sit and hunker down and watch water rise up, and can't do anything. I know men were struggling and running down to the beach to try, even as if we did prepare, they still had to run down to the beach to pull up their boats even further up because the water was rising pretty quickly. And men were also being affected by almost being hit with debris. And for the first time, we didn't sleep the whole night, and this was the first time I've ever felt so helpless where I knew I couldn't protect my own daughter and my family. Excuse me. So we waited out the storm. That's all we could do. And just by chance, my daughter, she came upon TikTok where people were posting live from Kip about their water coming in quickly and their homes were floating away. And people trapped in their houses, and even though they called for help, they couldn't get help. So it was a pretty hard time. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to go to the community and see where relatives' homes are destroyed. Where they had to leave everything behind and just bring a backpack. How do you leave looks that were passed down to you from your grandmother or your ancestors? How do you leave family pictures? How do you just leave everything and just carry what you can? But my people had to do that. And just coming into Anchorage, I wanted to go to the shelters and visit with my people. And I've never seen anybody, humanity taken away from them, as I described. Being in a floating house, looking out the window, and seeing their own loved ones in their coffins pass by their house. Were homes where they were floating away to be hitting each other as if they were bumper cars, to where they didn't know if their children were safe in another house because they separated, because nobody expected the storm to be this bad. Where this parent had let her children sleep at her mom's house, and they're just right next door, only for their house to be, for them to be drifted away. There's just so much that happened. Returning to being able to have eyes on the ground at Kipnik and Quigalup, just the smell was different. It didn't smell like our area. It was gone. One of our tribal administrations from Nightmute, Chris George, said they went to bed in the storm, and they're pretty inland, and you can only access it by river. He said they went home. They survived the storm, which usually there's tundra in the front, and they woke up to the ocean in front of them. That's how high the water came in. I know it's going to be a long recovery, and I know the trauma that we have suffered out there. But how do you leave a village where your ancestors came from, where grandmothers, grandfathers passed down the knowledge of where to hunt, when to hunt, how to process the subsistence catch? There's just so much loss. I just hope we get as much assistance as we can to rebuild. And thank you all for bringing up such great questions and showing your support. I don't know. I just want to close out by thanking Commissioner of DMVA, Major General Torrance Sachs, Director Brian Fisher, Mayor LaFrance in Anchorage, and the municipality, who just opened their arms to my people, and all the communities that took in our own, and all the entities that stepped forward. Thank you.
Anabasi, for your words, and you know, it's very helpful for us in this committee, both committees, to hear your thoughts and your words as we try to problem solve through this disaster where entire communities are basically uplifted and missing, destroyed. And I appreciate our community, our committee members here for asking great questions. I'm trying to help our fellow Alaskans. And Mr. Fisher, just thank you for all of your work in, gosh, trying to sew like all these entities together to help these communities. Anabasi. And any final words, Mr. Fisher?
To the chair, to members of both committees, Representative Jimmy, Koyana, thank you. We're all fellow Alaskans. You are our neighbors, and the agencies, all of the agencies are going to be in this as long as it takes to make sure we can get you home, back to where you want to be, and back on kind of the new normal moving forward. I can't thank all of you enough for your questions and your support. Make myself available throughout the session for any follow-up that needs to happen. I just want to say, particularly Representative Jimmy, but to all of you, thank you very much for acknowledging the responders from all the agencies and for highlighting what is a truly catastrophic event that we're all going to have to deal with for years to come. So thank you very much to the chair and the co-chairs and members of the committees.
Anabasi. Now I'll refer to my script. It'll help me get through. Director Fisher, thank you so much for coming back before the committee today. Your words were so helpful. I can't thank you enough, Anabasi. I appreciate the overview of the State Emergency Operations Center and the great discussions during this joint hearing. And from this discussion, I know that we'll be able to continue our problem solving of disasters like this here in the legislature, and look forward to those further discussions. And with that, I believe it is, look at that, 9:57, and the House Tribal Affairs is now adjourned. Thank you.